Tango Tango Papa, 1887, December 4th, 2014.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Cornersville, Tennessee. So, I had unloaded in Kansas City, Missouri, and then that was early yesterday morning. Then I reloaded ended up reloading in St. Joseph, Missouri, and then that load delivers tomorrow being Friday. Wow, this week is just zipped by. Delivers tomorrow at 12:30 p.m. in Birmingham, Alabama. So I've stopped here at Cornersville, Tennessee, and I think I've got about 140 more miles to go. I made sure I stopped in time so that I'd have an easy time of finding a place to park. Didn't happen. By the time I got out of St. Joseph last night, it was fairly late. I still had about 3 hours and 3.5 hours that I could drive. And so I made it I don't even remember the name of the town. It says exit 101 on I-70 in Missouri. And there's a Pilot truck stop there and a Love's truck stop. And it was exactly midnight, actually, when I got there, and almost all of the parking spaces were taken. There was a couple left, and I was able to back into one of them. Found a place to park, but this evening I stopped, you know, and there's really no point in me trying. I can't really go to the place because the place I'm going to doesn't have, they don't have much truck parking, and they certainly don't have overnight parking. So there's no point in me trying to get there this evening. So I decided, you know, I just might as well stop while it's easy to find a place to park. And so that's what I did, and then get up in the morning in time to make it down there by 12:30 p.m. and then unload. So, and it's possible that I could end up picking a load up out of there, because we do haul. I don't ever remember taking a load in there. It's possible that I have, but usually I've picked loads up out of that place. So some kind of a food company. So anyway, it was low 30s this morning in Missouri. It was above freezing, but it was like 33, I think, was the temperature that the truck showed, truck thermometer. And then now this evening it's like 40. I think when I looked earlier it was like 47 here in this part of Tennessee. So it's somewhat warmer, but that's to be expected because it's farther south. East. So, anyway, what I've been listening to a couple of audiobooks. One of them I listened to before. I bought it, at least a couple of years ago. Really good book. The name of it is The Master Switch by, the author's name is Tim Wu. That's, the last name is spelled W-U. Really an excellent, well-written book where he kind of goes into, he really delves into the history of the telephone and the telegraph and television, radio, and then including the internet. And he sort of details how that those systems kind of switched from being open to closed, and then sometimes they'll open back up, and then there's always a tendency for the thing to, you know, kind of close again. So you end up with open systems and closed systems, and he even towards the end of the book, he even talks even a little bit about Apple Computer and how Apple, it was Steve Jobs' vision that it'd be a really closed system versus Steve Wozniak, who actually, Steve Wozniak was the one that actually really came up with the Apple II and the modern computer as we know it, or at least it's what it started out as. That was really a Steve Wozniak invention. Steve Jobs is more of a salesman and worried a lot more about aesthetics and making money off of the different business angles, making money off of what they're selling. Of course, that's a necessary function if you're going to be in business. So, but Steve Wozniak wanted it to be open, but Steve Jobs wanted it to be closed, and he even goes into details about how that has hurt Apple in the past, especially when it came to Windows. Windows, you could argue that Windows is an inferior experience compared to all of the stuff, the personal computer stuff that Apple has had. But on the other hand, Windows, the reason Windows is successful, and it even despite all of Microsoft's bungles, the reason that it still dominates, and people forget that it does, it really does still dominate, even with the fiasco of Windows 8 and 8.1, Windows still is quite dominant, and the reason that it does is because it's a pretty open system, and you can take a bunch of different computer hardware and kind of mix and match and put it together and put Windows on it, and you've got a computer. Versus Apple, you've got the Apple hardware and the Apple software, and it's all kind of closed. And Apple has a real tendency to try to keep it as closed as they possibly can. Now, Tim Wu makes the point in the book that whenever Jobs came back to Apple, and then with the iPhone and the iPad, and even with the modern version of the Mac, it's still kind of a closed system, but it's open enough. But he learned the lesson that if he made it too closed, that he would really hurt people would reject it. So he opened it up. The idea was that he would open it up enough to kind of attract a largest possible audience, and then there's always this tendency they close it back down again. So, and then it was also a Jobs idea that he was even going to control what the end user did with the machine. And Apple still has those tendencies, obviously, in the wake of his death. So, but it's a very interesting book. And so I've got some audio from a video where Tim Wu is kind of giving a talk, and he's a very interesting fellow. There's a bunch of different interviews. Whenever this book, The Master Switch, whenever it originally came out, he did made the rounds and did all the interviews, and I remember listening at the time, and but the book itself, the audiobook is very interesting, and if you're into audiobooks at all, this is a really good one to get. It's top notch. So I got the audio for that, and then I've also it was time to get a new book. I'm on the Audible one book a month plan, and so I got a new book. And I started listening to it today, and it's talking about it's kind of a totally different topic, brain plasticity. And what brain plasticity is, and the author's name is Norman, I believe it, and that last name is spelled or pronounced Doyage, Dr. Norman Doyage. And I've got some audio for it as well. But what brain plasticity is, that has to do with the brain's ability to sort of rewire itself or shift its functions around. Generally speaking, there are different areas in the brain that you can go from one person to the next to the next. And generally, you're going to have visual processing is going to be at the very back of the brain, and different functions are going to be in different areas of the brain. But the brain also has the ability to, if it needs to, it has quite a remarkable ability to rewire itself, way more than was once believed, and. And I'm still in the I've listened to, I think, the majority of that book. It's pretty interesting. And then it's also, I don't know, as an aside, some of these different chapters, he's got the brain plasticity. For a long time, people, there was this tendency to think, at least among brain scientists, and they kind of preached it, that nerves couldn't regrow, and that once you were past a certain age, when you were a kid, you learn really easily, and then when you're past a certain age, it just kind of, your brain sort of, the wiring sort of sets, and you kind of become set in your ways, and you're just kind of screwed. And that's not really true. It's obviously easy, very easy for children to learn. But then you get to a certain point, and then it becomes somewhat more difficult. But even as an adult, if you really try, you can learn, and you can, and it's been shown through various means that even an elderly adult, your human brain, even in an elderly adult, has a remarkable ability to rewire itself. And so I'll be playing that as well. So I'm going to start out with the other part of that I was going to kind of comment on was the scientists, the brain scientists, and it became obvious as he kind of told the stories of these different people that were doing this research, that some of them were really faced some strong opposition, because it was thought that the dogma was that the brain was really sad, and it really wasn't there wasn't any plasticity, and they even ridiculed people, marginalized the people that were doing the research, to the point where they were actually marginalizing them, as almost as if they were researching UFOs or something. And of course, now that's kind of flip-flopped around, and they've proven essentially that the brain is very plastic. And it's not just the human brain. The brains that they research, monkey brains and rat brains and so on and so forth. And those brains are pretty plastic as well. So it's not just human brains are plastic. Mammal brains in general are very adaptable, plastic. They call it plasticity. So, but it was interesting. It's interesting because in science, the scientists, science is plagued. It's literally plagued with... it's really idolization. It's a type of idolization. Everybody sort of... the group think, everybody sort of thinks the same way. This is possible and that. We all ridicule whatever it is, this other thing that's been deemed... whatever the consensus is that... The consensus, the scientific consensus was that the brain was hard after a certain age. The brain was hardwired, and that was that, and that was the consensus. And you better think that way, and you dare not utter anything different, or they'd cut. You know, they'd even to the point where they would try to destroy people's careers and cut their funding and that type of thing. And it's really interesting how that works, but it's rampant. It's all over the place. And it's not unlike, we're going to pick on Apple a little bit more. It's not unlike people that sort of idolize, you have the people that idolize electronics. And I've been guilty of that, some of that. Idolize electronics, idolize the computer, idolize technology, and within that, then you have the people that idolize Apple, and some of the people idolize Sony. In the realm of motorcycles, you have the people that idolize Harley-Davidson, and demonize Japanese motorcycles. So within those groups, you have sort of subgroups that sometimes can dominate the thing and then ridicule anybody that's not part of the so-called mainstream group. And it's basically just idolization and group and attendant groupthink that happens. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play this first. File. This is it's about 40. So this is going to be a longer podcast. This file is about 40. I believe it's about 47 minutes long. And so this is Tim Wu.
And now it's my pleasure to introduce Tim Wu. Tim Wu is an information policy advocate, a professor at Columbia University Law School, and chair of the media reform organization Free Press. A graduate of Harvard, he was named one of the university's 100 most influential graduates in 2007 by 02138 magazine, and he's been recognized by Scientific American as a leader in science and technology. He's perhaps best well known for coining the term net neutrality, but his work has also encompassed issues of copyright, international trade, and various aspects of information and technology policy. He's the author of Who Controls the Internet? And his work has also appeared in Slate, the New Yorker, The Washington Post, and other publications. His new book, The Master Switch, details the history and current state of communications policy and argues that the fundamental differences between the information industry and other industries should be reflected in its regulatory policy. In his review for Boing Boing, Cory Doctorow writes that the master switch is fascinating, wide-ranging, and ultimately inspiring, and that Wu's great strength is the breadth of his scholarship and his ability to use humor, clear language, and innovative arguments to connect diverse ideas.
Hi, everyone. It's really a pleasure. Thank you for coming out tonight. It's an honor just to have anyone come listen to me talk about the book. I usually teach, and the students kind of have to come. they have no choice, and you can call on them blind, and hey, you answered this question. But no, it's a real honor to actually have people come, ostensibly because they want to. Sorry. Let me tell you about NPR. I'll get to the talk in a second, but I love doing NPR. But the strange experience about doing the NPR interview on Tuesday was sitting down, and I heard Robert Siegel's voice. You know, very beautiful voice. I was like, well, NPR is on. And suddenly I realized he was talking to me. It was like this. It felt like the Statue of Liberty had come to life to shake your hand or something. It was a very, very strange experience. But I guess I should talk about my book. I'll give you a quick summary of what my book is about. My book is the story of information empires. in American history. And so it is the story of the great companies, usually monopolies, the men who run those companies, and the tendency of rise and fall in this sector. It is more specifically a story of Western Union, AT&T, NBC, the rise of the Hollywood studio system, cable, the rise of the internet, and finally our current age, where an internet, which has been a revolutionary and very open technology, is increasingly controlled, and for better or for worse, by companies like Google, Facebook, telephone companies, and so on. So this is what the book is. If you pick up the book and read it, you'll find it. Most of it is a history. It's in narrative form. And a lot of it is about the people involved in these empires and what they were interested in. What I want to do today in the structure of the talk is to talk about what ideas or what things interested me to write this book and how they played out. And then to conclude by talking about, to take these two things I was interested in, see how they play out in the book, and then conclude with discussing our environment today and the current state of American information empire. So there's two things that interested me about when I began to write this book. I had worked for a long time in Silicon Valley, and like many people, I felt, and everyone around me felt, we were living in very different times, that our era was like no era that had ever come before. We were people living after the internet revolution. Much like after the American Revolution or after the crucifixion of Christ, there's a sense that nothing could ever be the same. How could, you know, this was the internet. Everyone can connect to everyone. And this is an ideology, a feeling, this sense that we live in very exceptional times in matters of how we communicate. Things are faster, more global. This is a pervasive almost article of faith for anyone who works in these industries. And I think a lot of us, just from our daily experience, we have the sense that you have 1,000 messages in your inbox, new companies arise every day, that everything is just changing like never before. But I had an instinct that, I wanted to know if this had ever happened before, whether there had been other eras where a great new medium had arose to change everything, whether there had been other technologies that were going to eradicate war, change the very nature of human existence. And so I wanted to figure out in some way whether the internet was actually different or whether it was following the same pattern established by technologies like the telegraph, the telephone, radio, cable, the other technologies that were revolutionary in their times. The other thing that has always profoundly interested me and fascinated me is something, a contradiction in the American character and maybe in human nature itself, which is the following. There is in the American tradition a great respect, a great admiration for things like competition, smallness, openness, the values of Adam Smith, the values of Jane Jacobs, the idea of small is beautiful. Yet the history of the industries I'm talking about do not reflect those values. They are rather a story of monopoly, powerful monopolies, and their consequences, repeated one after another. And so a lot of this book is a mediation on the American relationship with size. The contradiction between a kind of love or a stated taste, as I said, for things that are small, local, decentralized, open, and a tendency for this country to create mass giant information empires. There's other areas too, but companies like AT&T, companies like NBC, companies on a scale that the world had never seen before to rule over information. So those are the two things. And let me. And what I wondered in particular is whether there's something about us, Americans or North Americans, or even just as humans, as consumers of information, whether we read newspapers, watch news, or go to films, is there something about us that creates market power, that creates monopolies, that gives rise to Hollywood, to AT&T, to all these companies that dominate the history of 20th century American communications? So let me, it's obviously hard to talk a lot about history in a short time, but the book is full of stories which have the same essential repeating pattern, which in the book is termed the cycle. And I'll try to describe it briefly. Typically, something new is invented, whether it's the radio, telephone, or motion pictures. It goes through a period of some uncertainty. The initial inventor often has to struggle against efforts by existing firms to destroy or co-opt his technology. Eventually, the technology reaches a form and gives rise to what I call an open age, where suddenly it seems very easy for anyone to get in the market. And I'll give you a couple examples. About 100 years ago, anyone in this room could have started a telephone company. Just gone out, wired some houses together, started a little company, maybe the People's Company, Cambridge Telephone Company. It was actually, I think, a People's Telephone Company of Cambridge or something. They were very easy, right? Anyone just to start. It was a business that anyone could get into. 10 years later, it was very easy for anyone to start a radio station. I won't say anyone. You need to have a little bit of resources, but churches had their own radio stations, motorcycle clubs, radio amateurs all had radio stations. Anyone could be in this business. Film was an industry in 1910s, again, about 100 years ago. In 1914, I think there were 4,119 films made. In other words, 11 films made a day. Hundreds of producers, films on all kinds of topics. Now, these weren't, Gone with the Wind. These were not Lord of the Rings films. These were short films with very limited special effects, people falling over and that kind of stuff. But there was something that almost anyone could do, is be a film producer and be in the market. And that pattern has obviously repeated itself in our own lifetime. In the 1990s, I had many friends when I went to school here, went off to start websites. There are now a sense in the internet economy still that it's a relatively, well, we'll talk about this later, but especially in the 90s, that it was just something people got into, entrepreneurial, open. And there was also a sense, and I said this at the beginning of the talk, that in the early film industry, the radio industry in the 1920s, something profound was going on. That somehow, through the miracle of communications, humans might connect in new ways and start to overcome some of the greatest problems in human nature. That is to say, put an end to conflict, to war, to perhaps starting a new religious movement, to just a sense that something about these new technologies was going to change everything and, in fact, make it better. And things were never going to be the same again. What we then see in all of these industries is a shift that happens gradually. A number of factors are involved. But generally, some strong man shows up who takes the industry and manages to establish a more consolidated, more integrated rule. What was once a fragmented, very open industry, like the internet in the 1990s, becomes gradually, increasingly consolidated. Now, part of that comes from the consumer, and this is what really interests me, is that typically the open industries, film 1910, the internet 1990s, are attractively diverse and new. There's a novelty to them. But they're often quite unreliable. Quality may suffer, maybe somewhat amateurish. They don't have the size or the scale, often, that consumers want, or Americans want. And so, for example, in the film industry, the original of the Hollywood studios, Paramount, run by a man named Adolf Zucker, pioneered a very different kind of film, where he took the methods of Carnegie Steel or the Ford Motor Company and applied them to film. He said, what we need to do is we need to integrate every step of the production process. We need to own the actors, we need to own the cameras, we need to own the studios, all the distribution mechanics, all the way to the theaters. Everything that is film we need to own. And then with guaranteed audiences, with long-term contracts, he would be able to create what we now call the Hollywood film. Special effects, Gone with the Wind, King Kong. People liked it. Created a golden age, according to some. Gained was a new higher quality. Lost was the diversity and quantity. In the telephone networks in the 1910s, there was a period, as I said, very entrepreneurial. Anyone could start a company. It was a small company in Cambridge. But all these scattered telephone networks made it very hard sometimes to reach people. Quite confusing. AT&T, in the 1910s, headed by a man named Theodore Vail, who's a pivotal figure in the book, picked these pieces together and, like a conquering emperor, put them together into one giant kingdom called AT&T. And anyone who resisted him was crushed. And he put it, the American phone system, together into a single monopoly, effectively gained the assent of the American government, and ruled telecommunications for 70 years. Radio is a similar story, 1920s, I said, very diverse, very open time. AT&T, and I don't want to tell the full story, but AT&T was involved in that that industry as well, in an idea of what was called the network. This was the idea of making one show and sending it to 20 radio stations, instead of 20 old radio stations making their own shows. You can see that if you combine the resources, the amount of revenue available to an audience of 20 or 100 or 1,000 radio stations, you'll have a lot more money to make higher quality, at least it was called higher or more production, higher production value shows. And so on that basis, you saw the rise of NBC in the late 1920s. And particularly important in that story is a federal government interest in creating a single centralized, or not single, but a centralized radio system to serve the American public. So you have this repeated story that I call the cycle. From open and fragmented to closed and consolidated systems in American information. And my book is mainly the story of those cycles. Let me take you where that takes us today. We are sort of in the midpoint of what you might call an open era in American communications. The internet, popularized in the mid-1990s, is now 15 years into its rule. At this point in radio history, radio had already been gone from being the darling young technology of American amateurs to being what Joseph Goebbels called the spiritual weapon of a totalitarian state. That is to say, in 15 years of radio history, radio had already gone from sort of a beacon hope to a tool of the Nazi regime and of the Soviet regimes, actually, at the time, used to indoctrinate citizens. So the internet's doing better than radio. We can say this much. But the ancient and repeated power patterns of consolidation and integration are showing themselves again. And for better or for worse is something I'm going to leave somewhat open for debate. Let me just ask, how many people here use Google? Or maybe how many people don't use Google? Well, that's impressive. What do you use? The point is that Google, we'll get to say, but the Google has a monopoly over search, and I like Google. I use it myself. I love it. It's an attractive technology, but it has a monopoly over search that is undeniable. And it raises the question. All of us use Google, and we have created the Google monopoly by our choices. It's not like it was somehow foisted on us. The federal government, no one's been involved. We just have chosen it and made it king, essentially. And ask the familiar question that recurs through my book, is the question of whether we actually, in some level, love information monopolists so long as they are good. This was the deal that AT&T struck with the American people in the 1910s. It said, we will be good. They didn't quite say it like that. They said, we are a public utility. Our duty is to serve the people. We will deliver a national telephone system, the best in the world. All we ask in return is a monopoly forever. And so we said, great. Some level asked whether Americans at some level prefer, even though we have republic, have a certain taste for attributes of monarchy. Absolute power as long as it's handled responsibly. That is the question that Google raises today. Question number two that I think is raised by today's events, where we can see some of the same patterns reasserting themselves, is in a company like Apple. Apple's a very interesting company because they are copying, Steve Jobs is copying almost letter by letter the strategies used by the Hollywood studios in the 1920s. That is to say, he's pursuing a strategy of integration, of putting everything together. When you think about it, I don't know if you use iPhones or Macs, but the motto of them could be a motto from BBC in the 20s, the best of everything. You have networks, which are relatively fast. You have the devices themselves, which are beautiful. And Steve Jobs himself, using his charisma, has brokered the best deals with record labels, Hollywood, New York media, to give you the best of everything on the world's most beautiful devices. It is a compelling product. It has the same appeal that Hollywood film had in the 1930s. And that ideology is at our present in a war with Google, with the internet's values, which is part of what's so interesting, is the internet revolution was by design very different. It was meant to be or create perhaps forever a fragmented open system. But now we have a man who promises something beautiful, integrated, seamless, that works great, but it isn't open. And I guess I'll close on this final question. I'm about out of time. I guess the question for people who are interested, and I think this is everyone, I think everyone is interested in information because it makes you who you are. And everyone is interested in the tools we use every day, whether it's the internet, whether it's search engines, Facebook, or telephones, because they are our tools today. Humans are tool-using creatures. These are our tools. And so we have a natural interest in how something you use every day, you have a natural interest in how it works or where it's going. So part of what's very interesting is whether, in fact, again, we come back to my initial question, are we living in special times? With the rise of the internet and sort of a more open, a place where you can surf blogs or go into Twitter, and there's a million apparent sources of information. Is that just a phase, or are we headed in some way back to the patterns in the 1940s, 1950s, very comforting, where the whole nation essentially watched the same things at the same time? Maybe it'd be a little different, but that is the question. Every time you write a book, you have to decide what not put in your book and what to put in the book. And I didn't write about publishing not because I don't think it's interesting, but because when I looked at the history of publishing, I realized I'd have to go back to the 15th century. And it was it was very much also an English and European story. So it's not, there's no principle behind it. It's just the limits of space. Yeah, no, publishing's the same story. Yeah. You know, I haven't studied it in the same detail I've studied these other markets, so I don't want to like sort of offhandly say, yeah, it's exactly the same. But my instinct is the publishing has very similar patterns, which I wonder if my publisher would like me saying that, but anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. I think that the reason I chose the word information is I think that what is ultimately going on here, I think it's the most basic word, the root word. So inside the industry, there's a tendency to think, or even 50 years ago, people would say, well, broadcasting is one thing, the radio, telecommunications is another thing. But one thing you realize in the book, which is very interesting, is you realize that at the very early stages of most of these technologies, there's a plasticity as to what they will be. So, for example, the radio was invented in the 1890s. And for a very long time, it was just used from point-to-point communications, i.e. it was sort of a substitute for the telephone. The idea of broadcasting didn't become popular until 25 years after the invention. Similarly, telephone, for a while, people thought the best use of the telephone was going to be for mass entertainment. So they'd have concerts on the telephone. Sometimes there was news services on the telephone. There's some towns where the phone would ring 10 times at a certain time of day, and then you'd pick up the phone and you would hear the news and weather and some gossip and so. So there, and these were local, very interesting, because these were often local groups. So there would be you can imagine a small town. There's one town I studied carefully in New Mexico, where you have this small town and then there's a band, and at like 8 p.m. they have a performance and everyone's got their telephones. Everyone in the town has got their, not the town, but these are farms, so they're sort of spread out. Everyone in the is just listening. It's their evening entertainment. Just pick up the telephone and listen to the band play, which I guess is somewhere at the central switching station. So there's a plasticity in what all these technologies are. It's made more obvious by the internet, because the internet can carry any video or voice or anything. It's more obvious. And so, yeah, I chose the word information because I think it's least associated with either being the phone or the radio or film. They're all fundamentally ways of moving information. And I guess it's premised, I don't want to go on forever on this, but it's premised on the idea that there is something special about information as a product. That's what you said in the introduction. Something different about information and orange juice. Or boots, or even steel. One of the things I find is very interesting in the book is the people who get interested, they're always men. The men who are heading these empires, they're often motivated by something very different than money or regular success. But some opportunity, I think the opportunity to control people's minds has a real persuasive influence for people who become information emperors. They're a different breed. You see this with today's media moguls, even any of them. There is something more deeply appealing, I think, about information. Information is not a normal product because it affects, information you're presented with profoundly affects who you become, what you aspire to, what people think. So that's the reason I use the word information. That's a very interesting question. I mean, it's hard to tell because I got to repeat the question. So the question is whether consumers have changed in the way they react to things. Is that the right? Whether there's similarities in the way people reacted to radio and telephone and film and the way they people reacted to the internet, right? You know what actually got me, just speaking of people who have personally been through this, one of the people who I talked to about this book idea at one point was Justice Stevens on the Supreme Court. And he says, he's a guy who remembers meeting Babe Ruth. And we were talking about the internet, and he says, yeah, I remember when radio, that actually kind of got me started on my book in some ways, because he said, I remember when the radio was just getting started. I was thinking like, wow, you know what I mean? He said, we thought that was really exciting. And now we think the internet's exciting. So it's hard to tell because all you have to go by is, you know, newspaper accounts or talking to people. Let me say what I think is similar and what I think is different. So what I think is similar is that consumers tend to be extremely excited by the novelty of things at first, but then after a while, you know, so they're very excited and they have these huge booms. Throughout this history, you see there's booms that happen. There's a repeated pattern of booms. You know, 1 minute there's 100 radio stations and there's a million radio stations. Not a million, but, you know, thousands of them. But then they also tend to have this pattern, like I said, of becoming dissatisfied with quality problems, reliability problems. A lot of people left Bell's Rivals, not only because Bell destroyed them, but because they didn't feel the service was good, their equipment was shoddy, and so forth. So there is that pattern of getting really excited about something and then wanting more at a second point. What I think might be different, let me think, a few things that are different. I think there is at some stage more resistance to commercialism in earlier ages. There was a long time in radio early history where there was a massive movement against any advertisements on radio. People said, in fact, Herbert Hoover, you don't necessarily think as a sort of left-wing dude or something, he said it would be an abomination to have advertisements on the radio. It's such a miracle of science to be wasted with commercial chatter is just unthinkable. So I think there was in previous times an almost stronger, much natural sense of that the commercial should not come into different areas. And you think about how much we've abandoned that when Facebook starts and we don't even think, oh, you know, Google Maps are free or, you know, we don't sort of think about them as commercial entities. I mean, have you ever thought, oh, I'm not going to use Google because it has ads or because it's commercial? People, I don't think we have that same sensitivity that was around to some extent. There's more. It's a really good question, and let me say one more thing. I think that maybe, that's on one side. I think on the other side, it's hard to tell if it's consumers or just Americans. I think there was more of a worship of size in the early part of the 20th century than we have today. This idea that everything needed to be massive and an incredible faith in science and centralized systems, basically. So progress is always bigger and more centralized. So the bigger, more centralized telephone system is always the better one. In the 30s, government taking charge of things and the smartest people running it was better. If you're into management theory, Frederick Taylor prescribed that every corporation should reorganize how it does everything to make the smart people in the center run things, not the people in the shop. Right? So there was this faith, and I think we live in a different age where there's more. The 70s, there was a huge reaction against this in the 70s, small is beautiful, and essentially everything in the 60s and 70s was in some ways a rejection of letting the Pentagon and letting a couple agencies and a huge corporations run everything. They were like, you know, maybe we've gone too far with the centralization thing. The failure of the Soviet Union made centralized economic planning look a little less attractive. And obviously the Second World War made you think that there may be incredible centralization of everything can become totalitarianism. So there's this change in people's attitude and love for centralization, I think, changed. And our area, you know, Jane Jacobs is a very popular urban planner who people think the internet's great, Wikipedia, which did centralize. There's a much more, in our times, of a natural urge to think that small, local, decentralized is a good thing. Okay, the question is whether the internet is in some ways fundamentally different because you have a pattern whereby companies can start on top of another company's platform, right? That's part of what the internet revolution was all about. So let me talk about AT&T because it's the closest analogy. AT&T, that was always something that was, what you're talking about was always possible. I have a story in my book of a man who sells a device for putting over your telephone. This is the 1930s. Eventually the 1950s. It's a device you put over your telephone so people can't hear you when you talk, like this. So he wants to sell something that is in some sense on the AT&T platform. Everyone has a phone. He wants to sell an add-on to the phone like this, right? And so that you can't, and seems like reasonable. He sells it for a reasonable price. AT&T takes him to court to try to prevent him from selling this device. They see it as an abomination. And they say the entire phone system will be threatened if someone other than us is allowed to innovate on top of our platform. AT&T was opposed to anything that was called a foreign attachment, in their words. That is to say, anything made by someone other than them was banned from the system. So they ran this poor guy, Tuttle, around for decades, but that was just the least of it. Things like answering machines, AT&T, you know, talk about my book, I found this memo where AT&T had invented the answering machine in the early 1930s. In fact, they'd invented the tape recorder. But once they started thinking about this is Bell Labs, they said, you know what, we have to destroy this technology. The reason is, if there's tape recorders, people are going to stop using the telephone. Someone's going to tape their conversation. They might be talking about something embarrassing or obscene. So we, AT&T, have to stop this technology in order to preserve the greater value of the system. The system above everything. So the very idea of the Internet Revolution was to say, listen, maybe it's not the best thing to have one person in charge of everything. AT&T has been very innovative, but this idea of just only AT&T makes the phones and you can't sell a little device to go over the head, it's not a good idea. So anyway, I don't know if it fully answers your question, but what you're seeing when you see companies based on another company is at its heart the idea of the Internet Revolution. Yeah, that's a great question. The latter question is a question which I've been... Now, I don't want to spend a huge amount of time talking about media because I could spend forever, and I mostly want to talk about the book. But just briefly, I in the book I do talk about the role of the FCC, which is a very federal government in the history of monopoly and information. And it's a challenging role because the FCC can discipline monopolists. The government can break up monopolies through antitrust, like it blew up at Bell in 1984, which was, if you actually think about it, the reason the Internet started was because Bell got blown up. People don't always put these two things together. But there are these moments where decisive government action has a big effect. Particularly, I would say, blowing up companies. I'm not going to say you should blow up every company, but when the time comes, the history, to me, fairly convincingly proves that nothing has the effect on revitalizing a stagnant sector or giving it back to the people in some ways than blowing up a monopolist that has gone too far. Just a fact. The film industries are another one that's studied in the book, and breaking them into pieces, which they eventually cut them vertically in the 50s, made a big difference. But what can you ask from the FCC? The FCC has a very interesting history because it at times does nothing but support monopoly and keep monopolists alive beyond any time that they should be dead. It protected NBC and CBS for decades against cable television. Cable television invented in the 1950s and really didn't start getting anywhere to the mid-70s. Reason because they were under intense federal regulation that just stopped the business. Or stopped it from being in any cities, which is the same as stopping the business. So I think you have to be very cautious. Now, what can you do, you know, to demand that the FCC does the right thing? I do think public pressure ultimately matters, and I do think that having the kind, you know, even just showing up today and becoming interested in basically American information and who controls it is extremely important. I kind of, in the book, I write about this stuff as if it's... I write about what is often written by business writers, you know, the fate of companies in a more political and almost in a more political way, as more like the fate of nations. And I think that's how we have to think about these things, that they are the people who run information companies in some ways should be as accountable as America's rulers. Because they have a profound influence on the shape of this country. Beyond which, as I've said, shoelace manufacturers have. So I can talk to you later about all the secular details, but that's what I think matters ultimately. So the role of the military in the history, you know, the military has is an interesting question. They come and go. The first real information monopolist in American history is Western Union, the telegraph company, which I want to suggest is also the most terrifying in history. If they were 150 years ago, there was one way to move information quickly from one place to instantly. You really had two choices, post office or the telegram. The telegram was instant. The post office took however long it took. And it was a monopoly ruled by one company, Western Union. A critical fact, and let me talk, oh no, let me stay with that. One company, Western Union, long distance information movement. And what they did is they allied with the Associated Press which became the exclusive wire service for the nation. That is the exclusive source of instant news. So there's only one way you get news instantly, and that's through Western Union Associated Press duopoly. And they would just decide what they wanted the news to be on an instant basis. Most newspapers at the time, when you look at them, are about half Associated Press wires, because that's the only way you get instant news. And if it's something like war news, which I'm going to get to in a second, that's the news that you want to hear, and there's you're going to wait, you know, five-day-old news is not news. And that might be fine if, you know, they'd said do no evil or even vaguely had these kind of ideas, but actually they had the opposite ideas. They liked the Republican Party and that was it. So they generally, with some exceptions, did what they could to keep the Republican Party in power. This monopoly over instant news. Whether that meant not broadcasting news related to candidates they didn't like, whether that meant spying on Democratic candidates when they sent telegrams, it was just blatant in those days. It was like, you know, people talk about 2000 and Fox News being bad. There's nothing like, particularly the election of 1876. You can't even compare today's kind of news bias to the Associated Press in the 1870s. The overlap was the people who worked at Associated Press were also in the Republican Party. There's one situation I have in the book where it's the night of the election in 1876. And it looks like the Democrat has won. But Western Union gets hold of a Democratic telegram suggesting the Democrats are a little unsure about the South. And somehow, so Western Union gives this to the New York Times office of editors. The editors run, physically, one of the editors physically runs it over to the Republican Party, gets everyone up and says, claim the election, we're going to win this. Even though the Republicans had internally already conceded the election. So when you have the country's only mover of information on your side, it can make an incredible difference. And this may seem like a kind of abstract 150 years ago kind of thing, but imagine if Google became more powerful than even it is now, let's say. And I like Google, but imagine they just decided they liked one of the political parties in a profound way. They've got Gmail, or let's say Facebook and Google, put them together. They have Gmail, they have the ability to subtly alter search end results. If you look at the news page, if they put the news that is favorable to one candidate front of the front of the news and negative, you know, they are not all powerful, but it certainly helps. Now I can't. Oh yeah. So the military. One of the reasons that Western Union had this kind of power is the Lincoln administration during the Civil War. Liked the Western Union monopoly because this was their advantage against the Confederates. In setting up the often the military side of the administration finds it more convenient to have a monopolist in charge of communications. AT&T had a long partnership with the federal government, and so the first time, in fact, that the antitrust department tried to break up AT&T, the Defense Department killed it. They said AT&T is essential to national defense. We must have a monopoly in charge of American communications. In fact, AT&T ran for years, kind of amazing. They ran laboratories with access to nuclear technology. So you had a private company, you know, which everyone kind of trusted, that actually had access to nuclear bombs. That is a level of trust between the federal government and its greatest monopolist. It's fascinating to me because the American Revolution was. People talk about the Tea Party that was a revolution against crown monopolies in some ways. The original Tea Party was a revolution in some way against the British East India Company. But it's fascinating to me that even though this was the sort of spirit, we have this tendency to go back and create crown monopolies. To go back and create all-powerful companies that are deeply supported by government, whether it's the financial sector, which has been an arm of government. I don't know why we call it a private sector, because when it fails, it is part of government. I mean, it's a proof as part of government is, can you fail? Our major car manufacturers or our major airplane, they're all quasi-crown corporations in the sense that they are not allowed to fail. So, sorry, this is a little bit. The military also, yeah, so that's enough on the military. Now, it doesn't have the same patterns that you have in the financial sectors or so on. The most obvious candidate would be AT&T and Verizon, because they have the longest history. And they have the advantage of the reason AT&T and Verizon, no one here has ever said, you know, I'm going to start a mobile. You might start an app company, but you're never going to start a mobile phone company right now. And that's because to get started in that market, you need about $10 billion to talk about getting started. And even then, you're facing companies that are deeply entrenched. So the companies that have the closest relationship to government are AT&T and Verizon. The Bell. I mean, they're still AT&T. It's the Bell. So they're the ones that have the closest, and they're the ones that are the least vulnerable to competition, in a sense. Right? If you look at our cast of characters today who are powerful information companies, I think possibly Google, they could be displaced. It's much harder to displace the phone companies. No, it's a great question. The question is whether, I said that AT&T and Verizon have certain advantages from their relationship with government. Is the mobile internet going to change everything? First of all, I don't want to suggest that AT&T, the previous question was who are today's crown monopolists? And one thing I just want to suggest is the phone companies still have a closer relationship to government. It doesn't mean that they're all powerful. It means that they're much less vulnerable to competition. So that's the first thing. Second thing I wanted to say about mobile, what's very interesting today is if you look at you should notice if you start using your computer less and using your mobile phone more. I'm not saying that's a terrible thing. It's never very convenient. They're great devices. But these are devices with very different histories and legacies. Mobile phones, while they're more like computers, are still fundamentally telephones. And so they ideologically have inherited the DNA of the first telephone in 1876 and are fundamentally much more closed devices, generally speaking. They're generally devices that if you look at the iPhone, for example, it has a much more controlled experience. And so I think we are definitely seeing with the phones. The phones, I would say, are one of the major examples of a move towards a more closed internet. Now, Google is trying to fight this with Android and so forth, but the rise of the mobile phone and the relative decline of computers is one of the examples of what I'm talking about. It's one thing, I want to fold that into a conversation about censorship and privacy. The only thing I'll say, and it's very clear, is that when you study the history of all these of these industry, centralization, one company ruling everything, always makes it easier, or always creates problems of private censorship and privacy and violations. And it's obvious because one company having access to everything is just much more is a more effective infringer of privacy or user of privacy. The disaggregated, fragmented, open systems, everyone has a little piece of information. It's not necessarily that useful. Particularly true. I'm going to talk a little bit more about censorship because it's something the book talks more about than privacy. There were a lot of efforts in the 20s to censor the film industry. Success was so-so. The reason, again, is the industry had hundreds of producers, thousands of people. A film would be made. It would be supposedly banned, but you could still play in some theaters and pay the fine or bribe people. So there was this film censorship in the 20s was attempted, but not always successful. The period when film censorship became incredibly effective in the 1930s, when the industry had consolidated into six major studios. And then the Catholic Church, not the studios themselves, but the Catholic Church which had previously written a code as to what film should be, went to the six integrated companies and said, you must clear all of your scripts with us before you make these movies, or we will boycott Hollywood. And so we had a system from about 1934 to 1968 where every single Hollywood film went through the Catholic Church before it was made into a film. Not before it was shown, before it was made at all. And ultimately you had one guy, his name is Joseph Breen, who made the decision. So you had one man deciding the content of American film. That's the influence of consolidation. All right, thank you very much.
Okay, so that was a talk given by Tim Wu, author of, it's called The Master Switch, and well worth listening to, or reading if you want to buy the book. I mean, you're into reading. Of course, I find it much easier to be an Audible customer and simply listen while I'm driving. So anyway, the next file that I'm going to play, this is shorter. This is about, 25, 27 minutes. The author's name that's being interviewed is Norman Doidge. And he's talking about his book. And the subject is brain plasticity. And it's very interesting because what they're finding is essentially that not only can the brain, does it have the ability to sort of quickly rewire itself, but it also, a lot of the chapters in this book have to do with people that are, you know, you're almost using their own thoughts, and it's kind of been proven that you can use your thoughts and attention to cause the brain to kind of rewire itself. Your thoughts and attention also end up having an effect on your, which genes get expressed. So they end up having an effect on your genetics, which is pretty interesting. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play that. So this is the author his name is Norman Doidge.
For a long time, it was believed that the human brain was fixed or hardwired, and most forms of brain damage were therefore permanent and irreversible. However, scientists have since come to realize that far from being fixed, the brain has remarkable powers to regenerate itself, even in old age. Norman Doidge is a psychiatrist and medical researcher. In his new book, he explores the impact of this revolutionary discovery on all of us. It's called The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science. For years, we've been told that the human brain is like a machine, a computer, that there are different parts, that they're responsible for different functions, and if those parts break or wear down or are damaged, we lose that function. Now, in your new book, you throw this all on its head, and you say that, in fact, the brain is plastic.
Right.
Explain what that means.
Well, plastic means plastic in the sense of plasticine, modifiable, adaptable. The plastic brain is a brain that can change its structure and its function depending on both.
Without drugs or invasive?
Without drugs, just depending on what you do with your brain. The task at hand that you are working on, what you're perceiving can cause you to change the structure of your brain on many levels. And this is the most fantastic part, what you think and imagine actually can change the structure of your brain down to the very connections between the brain cells, down into the genes even. For instance, you know, one of the most staggeringly interesting discoveries of the late 20th century was the discovery that learning changes the number of connections between the neurons, the nerve cells, in a nervous system. You can go, for instance, from having perhaps 1,300 connections between nerve cell A and nerve cell B to 2,700 With several hours of training.
Simply by virtue of more brain activity occurring.
By virtue of learning and brain activity. So what happens is thoughts or activities that you do with your brain actually turn certain genes on and others off inside the nerve cells, which then make proteins, which then change the structure.
Now, why is this discovery considered so revolutionary? And more particularly, what are the implications of this discovery for people with brain dysfunction? A stroke, for example.
When you had a stroke, the general assumption was your brain got swollen, the chemicals were kind of deranged, and after a few weeks, whatever you were left with was what you would have to live with for the rest of your life.
You basically lost that brain function was damaged.
The cells died. They couldn't be replaced. The healthy ones around it couldn't reorganize. And so we were kind of waiting for the swelling to go away, and rehab was just sort of focused on getting you over that period. Now we know that rehab can actually reorganize the brain if it's done properly and bring many new functions back. But if I could just say it, it also meant that as you started to get older and your brain started to decline, it was like a machine that was wearing out. And the attempt to exercise your brain in the second half of life was really kind of unwarranted or waste of time. And so we just accepted a view of human development in which the second half of life is a period of necessary mental decline. And then, of course, the whole view of human nature that we have. We, you know, since the rise of modern science, most educated people see human nature in some way as emerging from the human brain. And if the human brain was fixed, immutable, and a rigid structure, it made a lot of sense to think of human nature as fundamentally fixed. And so we have to re-examine all that, and I begin to do that in this book.
Well, and you do it by way of story, and that there's some remarkable, almost logic-defying remarkable,
yes,
given what our traditional notion of what the brain is. Probably the most remarkable in it is the story of a woman who was born with half a brain.
Yeah.
Tell me about Michelle.
I went to visit Michelle because I thought that, I knew that she did have was born with one hemisphere alone, just half a brain, and I thought that whatever changes that she was able to undergo would really test this notion of plasticity, certainly at least in early life. And basically, when she was in the womb, some catastrophic event occurred, so her left hemisphere never developed. And based on what, the usual view of that the brain basically has certain areas which in the left hemisphere which are responsible for speech and other functions,
right.
Someone with that level of damage, you would imagine, would be unable to speak, unable to think. They might be alive, but on a respirator. And it turns out that that's not the case with Michelle. In fact, if you met Michelle, you would detect some subtle things, like one of her arms is a little twisted, etc., and her speech when she's upset, it's a little repetitive. But you would never dream, and nor did the people who examined her for a number of years dream that she had half a brain.
Well, explain this now. If we had thought that, okay, this part of the brain is responsible for speech and I don't have this part of the brain, how is Michelle speaking?
We know that there's a lot of plasticity early in life. But we also know, and I make this very clear in the book, there's plasticity from cradle to grave. But, you know, there are waves of increased plasticity. And it turns out that what the brain does is it learns how to do what it's got to do at the time. So parts of the brain that might have been devoted to other things will learn how to move. If it has to see to survive, they'll be devoted to vision. And so all these things can actually reorganize and move around. These higher mental functions.
To give our viewers even more kind of appreciation of the extent to which that's possible, retell the story that's in the book that you dub The Woman Who Was Perpetually Falling.
Cheryl Schultz was a woman, she had a hysterectomy and she was given a medication because she developed an infection called gentamicin. And it poisoned the vestibular apparatus, which is the balance apparatus in her brain.
Right.
And if you lose your sense of balance, you will feel like you're perpetually falling. When I was with Cheryl at one point, I asked her, what's it like when you've finally fallen to the floor? What do you feel at that point? And then she says, sometimes I just feel the floor opens up and I fall into a perpetual abyss.
Yeah.
So that was her life, and she ended up on disability. And one of the great people who were at the cutting edge. I call these people neuroplasticians, to coin a phrase. Paul Bach-Y-Rita invented a mechanism, and I was there when she was using the mechanism for one of the first times, that basically was attached to an accelerometer. An accelerometer is like a gyroscope. And the accelerometer would be in a hat on her head.
Like a construction hat.
Like a construction hat. And it would give signals that went into her tongue, of all places, telling her where she was in space. I tried it on. So you lean forward and you feel like champagne bubbles. They're really little electric shocks tell you you're forward. You lean back, it goes back. And she would put this hat on, and immediately, she'd be holding herself like up on a table lest she fall. And immediately her whole body relaxed. And this seemed like a miracle. Why? Because the sensory apparatus, the sense of touch on the tongue goes to a different part of the brain than the balance apparatus. So somehow or other, these signals coming in were making new pathways or strengthening very dormant pathways between her sense of touch and her sense of balance. So that was the first miracle. I saw that happening, and she had tried it on. But then there was a second miracle, which is as she started to use the machine more, she found she had a residual period where she would take the hat off. And at first the residual period lasted 30 seconds.
Residual period being that she still had balance. It had the same effect even though the hat was off now, right?
It lasted for, you know, a few seconds. And then it lasted longer and longer. And as she started to use the hat and take it home and use it, she would be going for days. And that was a true miracle, because what was happening, a miracle, I mean, it's only a miracle if you think that the brain is fixed.
Right.
It's actually not a miracle. Because she now no longer considers herself a wobbler.
Because the brain reordered itself and put the balance in a different part of the brain that wasn't damaged.
Yeah, and it developed new paths.
Now, is this sensory substitution? I mean, this is, again, another fascinating notion you introduced
in the book. This is what Paul Bach-Y-Rita called sensory substitution. He did this as well for people who had been congenitally blind. They'd never seen anything. And he rigged up a camera to a computer and then attached it. Originally was to the back, and there were vibrating pixels that were on the back. And then he put it in through the tongue. And he found that he could train a human tongue to function like a retina. And they would be able to see Twiggy. They would say, well, that's a picture of Twiggy. That's a picture of a vase. You've just moved a vase in front of a telephone. They could read certain things. If you threw a ball at them, they would duck. They could see perspective. I mean, so this is a remarkable
advance. They could see through their tongue?
What was happening is the tongue is like a two-dimensional surface, just as the retina mm-hmm, is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, basically...
That the images would be
the images
projected
would be on
the
tongue. And then we've recently learned, actually, this was some work also done in Canada, Bach-Y-Rita was from the States, that the input coming into the tongue was processed in the back of the brain, which we tend to call the visual cortex. Hmm. So it was all being rerouted, and Paul Bach-Y-Rita has found different ways to do sensory substitution, which is lay the groundwork for the notion of a retinal implant, but also other, you know, helping other people who have literally lost the ability to sense certain things.
We touched on the whole issue of stroke victims, and that you can tell a great story here about a surgeon in his mid-50s had a terribly debilitating stroke. Tell me how he came back.
Michael Bernstein, was out. He was playing tennis. He was a tennis. He spent the morning doing surgery on the eyes, so he needs a lot of fine motor skills. It's microscopic surgery, it's in a small confined space. Then he was playing tennis. Then he developed a stroke, and he couldn't move one side of his body. He went for conventional rehabilitation. They gave him whatever it was, the 4 to 6 weeks. And then they said, you're on your own. And he had very, very little control of his arm at that point, and very little control of his leg. And then he tried a new form of treatment. He happened to be from Birmingham, Alabama, where a man named Edward Taub had developed this new treatment called constraint-induced therapy. And one of the things the neuroplasticians have shown in hundreds of experiments now is that it's a use-it-or-lose-it brain. If you don't use something, it's that cortical real estate is taken over by something else. Now, What happens when a very common form of stroke is you have a stroke in the left hemisphere and you can't move your right hand.
You're paralyzed on the right side.
You can't move it well, etc. And so people try to use their arms. It doesn't work. And so they stop using them. Now, what Taub did ingeniously was he got people to put their good hands in slings.
Constrained them.
He constrained them. And then if a person could just do this, he would give them small amounts just to get a little more control over that, very incremental. And he worked them very, very hard. And they would have to do things like, you know, try to wash pots. And, you know, people would come in, they couldn't dress themselves, they couldn't eat, they couldn't put food on a fork. They literally would have been dependent for the rest of their lives. And Michael Bernstein was one of the first to go through this. And after 2 weeks of very intensive training, and that's not a long time. Okay?
No, it isn't.
He was able to function, get back to work, and function as a surgeon. And there are people who went to the Taub Clinic who, there was one person I spoke to who had his stroke almost 50 years before. He had been a little boy playing baseball when he had a stroke. He was they could help him all these years after the fact. I mean, that's just so remarkable because that plasticity and the ability to reorganize is in the brain. And it's even helped people who've had traumatic brain injuries. I think that's the kind of thing that would be very helpful for anyone who's got those not anyone, but many people with traumatic brain injuries. For instance, think of the soldiers coming back from Afghanistan.
Is this kind of therapy, or are these kind of treatments now finding their way into medical practice? No, because normally when someone has a stroke or any kind of brain damage, I mean, we really do look on it very, very fatalistically, and that the evidence is what we should. They don't improve.
Yeah. Look, we look on it fatalistically in part because studies that have been done in the past on people with brain damage and strokes showed that interventions didn't work. But now that the neuroplasticians have laid out the laws of this new science, there's reason to be hopeful for a number of kinds of brain injuries.
I bet. The notion of phantom pain, again, documented that people who lose limbs, they continue to hurt. You again claim that neuroplasticity both explains this and that researchers using the theories of neuroplasticity have been able to cure phantom pain. Tell me about that.
Well, phantom pain was one of the great mysteries of medicine. Mm-hmm. How is it possible to feel pain in a limb that isn't there? And what a neurologist named Ramachandran discovered was that in patients who've lost their arms and then get pain, or in one case, unscratchable itches, what happens is, if you remove an arm, there's cortical real estate, if you will, that had been devoted to moving that arm and feeling for that arm. It's now dormant.
In the brain,
cortical. In the brain,
yes.
Yeah. So adjacent cortical real estate takes it over. And in the typical human body map, an area that's very close to the arm is actually the face. And we now know that phantom pain is often caused because the face maps in the brain say, hey, there's more cortical real estate for us, and they start to move in there and reorganize the brain. There was one patient he had who had an unscratchable itch, mm-hmm. So that was a terrible affliction for him. And Ramachandran eventually figured that if he just scratched the man's cheek, the itch went away. And Ramachandran was able, by the way, to sort of trick the brain into rewiring itself using this same neural plasticity. One of the reasons that people would have these frozen pains is because once the input is stopped into the brain from the arm, it's as though that's the picture that remains in the brain. There's no new input to say, now the arm is moving again. Many people who had phantoms felt their arms were frozen and in pain. So he set up a mirror device where you would look at your real arm. Mm-hmm. Let's say this arm had been cut off.
Right.
You'd look at your real arm, and then you'd look into a mirror right here.
The brain would be tricking you, thinking that your arm was still
there. And you'd think that your left arm was moving, which of course didn't exist. You'd kind of put your stump near it. And that rewired the map so that the frozen phantom could move.
Now, I understand that neuroplasticity also tells us something about the nature of sexual attraction and love. What's that?
There's tremendous variation, of course, in what people are turned on mm-hmm, by, let's mm-hmm. say, sexually. I mean, you know, take situations in other cultures seem unnatural sometimes, and we learn that people can develop attractions. If you think of the whole idea that Chinese men 100 years ago in the aristocracy were totally turned on by women who had their feet broken and bound
up. Bound, yeah.
Okay. we start to realize that sexual tastes can be acquired, and we can acquire sexual types. And we're seeing a lot of this happening now, actually, with the internet and internet porn, in a way. You know, there are a lot of stories that started to become public in the 90s about men who would get on the internet, and they'd sort of just be searching around, and then they'd fasten onto certain images that would really turn them on, that really surprised them. And then they would practice them over and over and over again. And they would have orgasms. And when a person has an orgasm, they secrete a brain chemical called dopamine, which actually reinforces the circuit and rewards them. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter or a brain chemical that's very involved in consolidating a new circuit. And these men would start to develop new sexual attractions that at times seemed bizarre to them. Sometimes they dipped into childhood things. I mean, one story I talk about in the book is a man who developed an attraction to spanking sites. And if you think about it, spanking would seem to have to do with early childhood. But the other thing that was happening for these men, and this was reported over and over, and I saw it in clinical practice, is they said that for a mysterious reason, they were losing interest in their own partners, even though objectively they found them to be attractive. So here was a case where because of plasticity, people were inadvertently rewiring their brains. And plasticity isn't always a good thing.
And it can lead to rigid behaviors and obsessions,
and I guess. In this case, it leads typically or very frequently to a kind of an addiction. And if you think about it, addictions are about plastic change in the brain. There are certain people who, if they have alcohol, they have a chemical sequence that's fired in their brain, and a chemical called Delta-Fos-B is released that changes their brain permanently. That's why sometimes it does make sense for a person to say, even though they haven't had a drink for years, I'm an alcoholic. It's, in plasticity terms, my brain has been structurally altered by my interactions with alcohol.
Now, interesting you say that, because they also point out that psychoanalysis can be used to open up the brain's pathways and reorder the brain's function too. I think you call this neuroplastic therapy.
Yeah.
Explain to me what that is and how it would work.
It turns out, from what I, you know, based on what I told you before about, you know, thoughts altering genetic behavior, that thoughts in therapy are actually changing brain structure as well. They change different brain structures, but the major therapists that we know that are successful, and that includes psychoanalytic therapies, cognitive behavioral therapies, something called interpersonal therapy, they're all for slightly different conditions, all rewire the brain, all change the balance in the brain's department. So they are every bit as biological, if you will, an intervention as the use of drugs. And the advantage of psychotherapies, if you don't absolutely need drugs, and I want to say, I mean, I use drugs sometimes, but the advantage of them is they don't have as many side effects in general. And if you think about it, drugs, as they are today, are very blunt instruments. You take a pill and it goes and it obeys every cell in your brain and, in fact, in your body. And that's why we get so many side effects. And it would be, to a certain extent, if you're using thoughts for the intervention, you're like more like a microsurgeon going into the thought patterns that are problematic.
Do we know enough about the brain to be that precise in terms of psychiatry and psychoanalysis?
In other words, if I make an interpretation
right.
about the meaning of a behavior, do I know where in the brain it's going? Well, if we're treating, let's say, an anxiety problem, right? We now know that if you use psychoanalytic psychotherapy and you take a person before the therapy and you take the thing that's making them anxious and you make them think about it or attend to it, the part of the brain that's likely to light up and trigger the sort of bolts of anxiety, and after they go through the therapy, if the therapy works, those parts of the brain aren't triggered.
Now, you have an absolutely horrifying statistic here about our generation, the baby boomers, those between 40 and 60, that they have over a 50% chance of reaching the age of 85, and that 85-year-olds have a 47% chance of having Alzheimer's. We're going to have a population full of dementia. I mean, what can baby boomers do to enhance their brain power and ward off that disease?
Okay, so there's two things that we worry about when we think of mental decline as we get older. One of them is a more benign thing, and more common. It's called age-related cognitive decline. Mm-hmm. The senior moments that begin in our 50s that frighten people. And then there are the serious dementias. So the good news is that we know for a fact now that age-related cognitive decline is reversible through brain exercises. And I met with a man, Stanley Kuransky, who was 90, who started to have some difficulties with senior moments. His handwriting was sloppy. He was no longer alert. He wasn't socializing much. And in 6 weeks, roughly an hour a day, he was able to reverse all of that.
What was he doing?
He was doing a program called Posit Science that I describe in the book.
Now, this is a company, an actual company.
Yeah.
Tell me more about it, because they claim they can make 80-year-olds feel like 50-year-olds.
Well, they've shown it. Posit Science was set up by perhaps the world's leading neuroplasticity researcher, Michael Merzenich. And he's already a man of great accomplishment. He was one of the inventors of the cochlear implant that allows the deaf to hear. He's helped kids with learning disabilities, with reading disabilities, move from problems to basically normal or above normal levels. And they set up a program that rebuilds the auditory cortex, the part of the brain that processes language, from scratch in older people. What happens is that we age. One of the reasons that we cannot remember things is our brain maps for sounds are just kind of getting dulled. They need to be tuned up at the very basic level of distinguishing sounds like ba and da and pa. The reason is we haven't really used them intensively. Often, once we hit middle age, we are usually replaying mastered skills. Mm-hmm. But to maintain a brain in good shape, you've got to work as hard as you worked when you were learning a French vocabulary in high school. Maybe you didn't work at it, but as hard as you should have worked at
it. Sure.
And so people go for decades without putting themselves through that intensive kind of training. And the cortex just kind of gets dull, and you develop what are called fuzzy engrams. You don't hear the sound of the person's name at the party crisply. So they rebuild it from the ground up.
Now, how would our viewers get this program?
Posit, P-O-S-I-T, science. Just go to put that in the internet, and you'll come to the website for that.
What do you think the next big breakthrough is in brain research? What's the next big thing we should be watching for?
It's the translation of the fundamental laws of brain plasticity into applications for everything. In therapeutics, in all kinds of training, you know, that means sports, the military, education, anything you want to do and develop. Right now, basically, many of these disciplines have an intuitive grasp of some of the laws of plasticity, but the neuroplasticians can help sharpen and speed up learning. So that's where I imagine it would come. I know that people will want to get very highfalutin and try to facilitate neuroplastic change with chemicals, and some of that might be doable, but that's also very problematic for the reason I said, that chemicals are still a very blunt instrument.
At a personal level, I mean, this book is full of very, not just amazing, but inspirational and uplifting stories. I mean, over the course of doing the research, did it kind of change your sense of what human potential and perhaps even human nature is?
Yes, it did. One of the most important insights I think I had while doing the book was what I call the plastic paradox, and that is this. That plasticity, the brain is always plastic, but it can give rise to both flexible or rigid behaviors. Mm-hmm. It can give rise to rigid behaviors because once those networks are established, they tend to outcompete the other one in a war of nerves that's going on inside our head. You know, the human brain is a habit-forming thing. So the way to understand plasticity is think of it as like a hill, snow on a hill in winter. And we want to ski down that hill, so we get to the top of it. And because the snow is plastic or pliable, we can take many paths down that hill. But it being a hill, it has rocks and trees, and will be inclined towards certain favorite paths. Now, as we keep using those paths, again, precisely because the snow is pliable and plastic, we'll develop tracks and ruts. And what we do in our lives, and what is we tend to think that because we're stuck in a rut and repeating something, that not only is the behavior rigid, but the underlying brain is rigid. So when I'm working with patients, I try not to get fooled by the plastic paradox. Mm-hmm. And they're often fooled by the plastic paradox. And I would submit that all of humanity, to a large degree, has been fooled by the plastic paradox. I think we've underestimated how plastic our brains really are.
Dr. Norman Deutsch, I want to thank you very much for joining me. It's been fascinating and a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was author Norman Doidge being interviewed about his book, and he's talking about brain plasticity, its ability to rewire. Very interesting stuff. So anyway, better be cutting this off. See if I can get this uploaded and posted, and try to also do a video. I didn't do one last night. After I stopped, I just didn't have time. I had to get to bed, and this evening I got a little bit more time. So enough time to record a podcast and make a video and not cut into my sleep. So, anyhow, from where am I at? Cornersville, Tennessee. I hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.